ॐ अज्ञानचमनन्दस्य जनार्जनसलकया चक्षुस्मृतान्येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थपितां जैनभूतले सायं प्रकदमायां प्रतिशापनतिकम् पञ्चकौपतुभ्यश्च कृपसन्धुभ्यश्च पतितनं भवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। Just completed Maharaj Prickett's hearing, or Sukadev Goswami speaking a purport of the forest of material enjoyment. And it was a description, elaboration of the previous chapter where Jada Bharat concluded his preaching to Maharaj Rahugana. Personalities like Jada Bharat, practically speaking, they have nothing to do with the material world, although they're in it. Seemingly they're in it. Their bodies appear to be in it, but their consciousness has nothing to do with the material world at all. Means they have no relationship with their material mind, or they've conquered their minds. And as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, for one who has conquered his mind, the super soul is already achieved. Because the mind is that thing that becomes attached and averse to the objects of the material world, and that is dvandva mohina bharata. That is the duality that binds us, the attachment and aversions. I like this, I don't like that, I want this, I hate that. Icha dvesha samutena dvandva mohena bharata. So he had completely controlled his mind, completely learned to neglect his mind, and he was transcendentally fixed in devotion. So after the description of Jada Bharat, that was actually the conclusion of the pastime of the son of Rishabdev. The foremost son of Rishabdev was Bharat Maharaj, and Bharat Maharaj he was completely renounced, and in his next life, because he developed some small attachment to a deer, he became a deer, and then he became the great devotee Jada Bharat, and then we heard about his incredible dealings. Now, Rishabdev Maharaj was the son of the great grandson, I believe, of Priyavrata. Who is Priyavrata the son of? Of Manu. And his brother, his younger brother, was Uttanapad. So in the fourth canto we heard about the descendants of Uttanapad, beginning with Dhruva Maharaj and going to the Pachetas. And then, because there was no suitable person after the Pachetas, then the ruling was forced upon Priyavrata. So in this canto, we've been hearing about the descendants of Priyavrata Maharaj, going up to Rishabdev and Bharat Maharaj. And now we heard about the lives of Bharat Maharaj, and now we're going to hear the descendants of King Priyavrata, the other descendants of whom one name of the name of Gaya was most prominent. But this chapter, the 15th chapter of the fifth canto, is a transition chapter. It's not exactly connected to any other pastime, and from there the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam will change its direction to describing some different aspects of the universe. So following this chapter, the direction will change from describing the descendants of Priyavrata, which also was a description, part of the bigger description of the descendants of Swayambhuva Manu, which, and that began in the third canto, and then continued to the fourth canto, and now Priyavrata, the elder son, and his descendants have been described up to the fifth canto. Now in this chapter we're going to complete that description, at least for the time being. So let us listen carefully to this chapter and see what we can learn from it. Sri Sukadev Goswami continued, "The son of Maharaj Bharat, known as Sumati, followed the path of Rishabdev." Now what was the path of Rishabdev? Anyone remember? What was his method of self-realization?
He was not talking.
He completely neglected his body and mind. He showed that one can be fully happy, that happiness, we think at this point in our existence, we think that happiness, if we think of things that will make us happy, what do we think of? We think of so many external things. But Rishabdev Maharaj showed that one could be completely happy and have nothing to do with either his body and getting no physical or mental satisfaction. That one's happiness can be completely in with the internal energy, connected to the internal energy. He was a complete avaduta. He stayed at home for a while, then he completely left home and wandered around not caring how anyone treated him at all. So the son of Bharat Maharaj, known as Sumati, followed the path of Rishabdev. But some unscrupulous people imagined him to be Lord Buddha himself. These people, who were actually atheistic and of bad character, took up the Vedic principles in an imaginary, infamous way to support their activities. So there was a perversion of the practical application of the Vedic philosophy there. This also happened with Arhat, following Rishabdev as well. Thus these sinful people accepted Sumati as Lord Buddhadev and propagated the theory that everyone should follow the principles of Sumati. In this way they were carried away by mental concoction. So in Prabhupada's purport, he describes the Jains and the Arya Samaj, and he doesn't describe them very, very favorably. The Jains, he also described in relationship to Rishabdev and Maharaj Arhat, and in a very critical way, because ultimately the Jains, the Arya Samaj followers, the Arya Samajas don't accept the deity worship. They don't accept the Vedic Acharyas. They don't accept the commentaries on the Bhagavatam. Their teachers, as Prabhupada explains, say that we actually know the purpose of the Vedas. They accept the Vedas, the Arya Samaj. We know the purpose of the Vedas. But as Prabhupada explains in his purport, what is the purpose of the Vedas? Vedes chasavar aham evo vidyo, Krishna says in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. By the Vedas, who is to be known? What is the actual purpose of the Vedas? It's to know Krishna. So if someone comes up with a different conclusion as to what what is to be gained by the Vedas, then he leads other people. He's leading people in the wrong direction. And the Buddhists, Lord Buddha, he taught in a wonderful way, ahimsa paramo dharma, that the highest form of religion is ahimsa, which means non-violence, because people were engaging in animal slaughter under the excuse of the Vedic Shastras. So he stopped that. And he had everyone sitting down and meditating and non-violent. This is called Sila in the Buddhist tradition. Sila means the morality, because before one can achieve the proper goal, one must be moral, and again, ahimsa paramo dhamma. The highest morality is non-violence. So we had everyone sitting and meditating. But what was the goal? Didn't actually speak much about the goal. But his goal was to have everyone worship him, because he was the Lord, and that would benefit them. And you see this if you've ever been to, I guess there's so many different Buddhist traditions. There's Buddhism in Burma, there's Buddhism in Thailand, there's Buddhism in China, and there's Buddhism in Korea and Cambodia, Vietnam, so many, they're all completely different from each other. I once went to Korea many, many years ago, and I saw that the people are, they walk into the Buddhist temples, and there's big statues of Buddha. Everyone bows down three times to the statues. In this way, even though they are considered atheists, because the goal of Buddhism is sunya, is nothingness, the annihilation of the self. It's actually a peculiar philosophy. They say that the goal is that there is no self, there is no soul, but yet something transmigrates. And it's based on the different sanskaras or impressions that we have, that we make up, all the different karma. So that thing transmigrates, but there's nothing there. So when you remove all the sanskaras, all the impressions, all the karma, nothing exists. But yet that nothing somehow became into a person, and there's no supreme who started this incredible system. There's nothing somehow got enwrapped into an individual's soul who transmigrates, seeming like a soul, and then when you take away all the coverings, there's nothing left. It's something like impersonalism. But the impersonalists say that it's like the difference between undifferentiated spiritualism, because you become one with Brahman in the impersonalism, and in the Buddhism you become one with the material energy more. There's nothing, there's no such thing as spiritual. So it's actually a unique philosophy. And even today, nowadays, the Buddhists, many of them aren't even vegetarians. They preach like this, but they're not even vegetarians. How they can possibly justify that? I have no idea. They talk about non-violence and kindness to all, but yet they eat the animals. So even the most popular Buddhists, they're not even vegetarians. So it's quite peculiar. So Buddha himself, even though he said there was no God, no spiritual world, he himself was an incarnation of God. He's considered nashtik or atheist. Well, he's the follower is supposed to be respected but not followed. So that was Sumati. From Sumati, a son named Devatajit was born by the womb of his wife named Vridasena. So there's a succession of kings here. Thereafter, in the womb of Asuri, the wife of Devajit, a son named Devadumna was begotten. Devadumna begot in the womb of his wife Dunamati a son named Parameshti. Parameshti begot a son named Pratiha in the womb of his wife Suvarchala. King Pratiha personally propagated the principles of self-realization. So he is being pointed out as a very powerful preacher. He propagated the principles of self-realization. In this way, not only was he purified, but he became a great devotee of the Supreme Person, Lord Vishnu, and directly realized him. Here's Prabhupada's short purport about Maharaj Pratiha. The word anusasmara, is very significant. God consciousness is not imaginary or concocted. Anusmara means perfectly understood and always remembered. So it is not concocted. The devotee who is pure and advanced realizes God as he is. Maharaj Pratiha did so, and due to his direct realization of Lord Vishnu, he propagated self-realization and became a preacher. A real preacher cannot be bogus. He must first of all realize Lord Vishnu as he is. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Upadakshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshana. One who has seen the truth can impart knowledge. The word tattvadarshi refers to one who has perfectly realized the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such a person can become a guru and propound Vaishnava philosophy all over the world. The paragon of bona fide preachers and guru is King Pratiha. So he's glorified here, King Pratiha. A descendant, a wonderful descendant of Priyavrata and Bharat Maharaj. In the womb of his wife, Suvarchala, Pratiha begot three sons named Pratiharta, Prastota, and Udgata. These three sons were very expert in performing Vedic rituals. Pratiharta begot two sons named Aja and Bhuma in the womb of his wife named Stuti. In the womb of his wife, Rishikulya, King Bhuma begot a son named Urgita. From Urgita's wife, Devakula, a son named Prastava was born. And Prastava begot a son named Bibhu through his wife, Nayutsa. In the womb of his wife, Rati, Bibhu begot a son named Pratusena, and Pratusena begot a son named Nakta in the womb of his wife, named Akuti. Nakta's wife was Druti, and from her womb the great king Gaya was born. Now from here, there, until practically the end of the chapter, which is a short chapter, 16 verses, this is the sixth verse, it's going to discuss the characteristics of King Gaya, who was quite famous. Have you ever been to the city of Gaya? Anyone else? Did you see Vishnupad there? Did the pandas give you trouble there? Little. So the pandas there, the priests, they're really heavy. They're famous for being heavy in Gaya. They're trying to squeeze money out of the pilgrims, and they even gave Lord Chaitanya trouble when he went to see the Vishnupad, the lotus feet of the Lord is there. Footprint of the lotus feet of Vishnu is there in Gaya. But this is not the city Gaya. This is the great king Gaya was born. Gaya was very famous and pious. He was the best of saintly kings. Lord Vishnu and his expansions, who are meant to protect the universe, are always situated in the transcendental mode of goodness, named Vishuddha Sattva, means pure goodness. Being the direct expansion of Lord Vishnu, King Gaya was also situated in the Vishuddha Sattva. Because of this, Maharaj Gaya was fully equipped with transcendental knowledge, therefore he was called Mahapurusha. So he is called a Kala. There are different types of incarnations. So in the first canto it says, Ete Changsa Kala Pungsan Krishna Stu Bhagavan Sayam, that there is the, of all the incarnations that come from the Purusha, there is the Angsa and the Kala. The Amsa is a part of the Lord that comes. And then there is a part the incarnations that of those parts of the Ankhas are called Kalas. So he was a Kala incarnation. So now we'll hear something about Maharaj Gaya. King Gaya gave all protection and security to the citizens so that their personal property would not be disturbed by undesirable elements. Now, why is it important that the citizens get security? So much of our, with their personal property, so much of our preaching is that in the material world everything is temporary. You can't keep anything. Everything will be ripped away by time. You'll have to leave everything behind at the time of death. So why is it so important for the king, on the other hand, to give security to the citizens?
Like a father, so that the subjects can fulfill and perform their duties without anxiety.
Yes. Anyone like to say a little more about that? So that their minds, because if someone's always afraid of losing their material possessions, their minds are going to be so disturbed if they're materialistic. And everyone in the world is materialistic, basically. So always in anxiety, oh, I'll lose this, and the thieves are going to come, and this is going to happen. And now so much anxiety, their minds will be so disturbed, and when someone's mind is... it's so disturbed, it's so difficult to either perform one's duties properly, what to speak of, think about what the purpose of life is. So the king, his job is to provide material security so that people can peacefully, or the executive head, provide material security and make sure that there's spiritual guidance, but so that the people can peacefully prosecute their duties, so that they can have their material necessities fulfilled without so much anxiety, without so much competition, without so much difficulty, so that then they'll be able to think properly about life and keep everything in perspective. He also saw that there was sufficient food to feed all the citizens. This is called poshana. Poshana means protection. He would sometimes distribute gifts to the citizens to satisfy them. That is called prinan. Just imagine if you get something directly from the king, a gift, how fortunate one would feel. Especially if he was an exalted, respected, worthy person. He would sometimes call meetings and satisfy the citizens with sweet words. This is called upalalan. He would also give them good instructions on how to become first-class citizens. This is called anusasana. Such were the characteristics of King Gaya's royal order. Beside all this, King Gaya was a householder who strictly observed the rules and regulations of household life. He performed sacrifices and was an unalloyed pure devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was called Mahapurush because as a king, he gave the citizens all facilities. And as a householder, he executed all his duties so that at the end, he became a strict devotee of the Supreme Lord. As a devotee, he was always ready to give respect to other devotees and to engage in the devotional service of the Lord. So he had duties as a king, he had duties as a householder, he had duties as a devotee, and in all cases, he performed those to perfection. How sweet the description of how he dealt with the citizens. He protected them. He gave them food. He made them secure. He would distribute gifts to them. He would call meetings and speak sweetly to them. and he would give them good instructions. So he performed his duty and he performed sacrifices as a householder. So in this way he performed all his duties perfectly. And as a devotee, listen to what his characteristics were. He always was ready to give respect to other devotees and to engage in the devotional service of the Lord. To respect the devotees and to serve the Lord. This is the bhakti yoga process. Due to all these transcendental activities, King Gaya was always free from the bodily conception. He was full in Brahman realization. What does it mean to be Brahman realized and a devotee? Brahma Bhuta Prasanatman Asochati Nakanchati Savasameshu Bhuteshu Madbhakti Labhate Param. What does it mean? It means not identifying with the body, identifying with oneself as a soul, as a servant of Krishna. And Nasokchati Nakanchati. He was always jubilant, always happy. He did not experience material lamentation, Nasokchati Nakanchati. Although he was perfect in all respects, he was not proud, nor was he anxious to rule the kingdom. How nice, yes? Prabhupada, in his purport, he explains something about the duties of kings. As a representative of the Supreme Lord, the king had the duty to protect the citizens in a perfect way so that they would not be anxious for food and protection and that they would be jubilant. The primary responsibility of the king, the executive head, is to make sure everyone has enough food to eat. And also to make sure everyone is engaged in their prescribed duties. But then Prabhupada explains, in Kali Yuga, monarchy is abolished. Monarchy was so good, but why is it abolished in Kali Yuga? Hundreds, a few hundred years ago, there were so many different kings. So in Kali Yuga, monarchy is abolished because the kings themselves are subjected to the influence of Kali Yuga. It is understood from the Ramayana that when Bibhishan became friends with Lord Ramachandra, he made a vow that if he by chance broke the laws of friendship with Lord Ramachandra, he would become a brahmana or a king in Kali Yuga. He like cursed himself. This will be the result. If I do something so horrible as break my friendly relationship with Lord Ram, I'll get the most horrible result, become a brahmana or a king in Kali Yuga. And this is also described in it's quoted anyway in the Bhagavatam in the first canto in relationship to the cursing of Maharaj Prickett, that the demons in Kali Yuga, they take their birth in brahmana families. In this age, as Bibhishan indicated, both brahmanas and kings are in a wretched condition. Actually, there are no kings or brahmanas in this age. And due to their absence, the whole world is in a chaotic condition and is always in distress. Compared to present standards, Maharaj Gaya was a true representative of Lord Vishnu, therefore he was known as Mahapurush, great person. Prabhupada says it in Kali Yuga, there's no, we quote so many times, Kalo Sudra Sambhava, that everyone in Kali Yuga is born, not as a brahmana, regardless of the family that they're born in, everyone is Sudra. I saw him one time in Japan, there was one favorable Indian gentleman named Mr. Santanam. He was the manager of the Bank of India in Kobe. And we knew him from Tokyo, and then he got transferred to Kobe. And then when he met Prabhupada, he wanted to tell Prabhupada that he was a Brahmin. So he started saying to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, your disciples are better than me, even though, and he went to, even though, because he wanted to say that he was a Brahmin, even though I am, and he began to pull out his thread, and Prabhupada said, no, Kalo Sudra Sambhava. Everyone in Kali Yuga is a Sudra, born a Sudra. And so then Mr. Santanam, very nice man, said, no. Even though your disciples are better than me, he did it again. Even though I am, anyway, and Prabhupada said, no. He wouldn't let him pull out his thread to say that he was a Brahmin. It's one of the qualifications of a Brahmin is he cannot accept service. It's one of them. Accepting service means that accepting employment for another, because when you're employed by another, you lose your independence. You have to do as you're told. You can't follow your integrity. So Brahmins have to be independent. They're allowed to, even in an emergency, take up business as an occupation, but not allowed to take up employment for someone else. This is the Vedic system, because they lose their character in that way. So Maharaj Gaya, not in Kali Yuga, was the real thing, a real Kshatriya. He knew exactly how to take care of the citizens. He was empowered. A Kala is actually an incarnation. My dear King Cricket, Sukadev Goswami says, those who are learned scholars in the histories of the Puranas eulogize and glorify King Gaya with the following verses. These kings are explained in the Bhagavatam so that the present rulers will have some guiding light on how to rule. They should emulate these personalities. Here's one of the verses. The great King Gaya, Gayam Ripaka Pratiyatikamabir Yajva Bhimani Bahuvidam Gopta Samagata Sri Sadasapati Satam Satsevako Anyo Bhagavat Kalamrite. The great King Gaya used to perform all kinds of Vedic rituals. He was highly intelligent and expert in studying all the Vedic literatures. He maintained the religious principles. He retained the religious principles and possessed all kinds of opulence. He was a leader among gentlemen and a servant of the devotees. He was a totally qualified plenary expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, who could equal him in the performance of gigantic ritualistic ceremonies? Another verse. All the chaste and honest daughters of Maharaj Daksha, such as Shraddha, Maitri, and Daya, whose blessings were always effective, bathed Maharaj Gaya with sanctified water. Indeed, they were very satisfied with Maharaj Gaya. The planet Earth personified came as a cow, and as though she saw her calf, she delivered milk profusely when she saw all the good qualities of Maharaj Gaya. In other words, Maharaj Gaya was able to derive all benefits from the earth and thus satisfy the desires of his citizens. However, he personally had no desires. Prabhupada's purport. The earth over which Maharaj Gaya ruled is compared to a cow. The good qualities whereby he maintained and ruled the citizens are compared to the calf. A cow delivers milk in the presence of her calf. Similarly, the cow or earth fulfilled the desires of Maharaj Gaya, who was able to utilize all the resources of the earth to benefit his citizens. This was possible because he was bathed in sanctified water by the honest daughters of Daksha. Unless a king or ruler is blessed by authorities, he cannot rule the citizens very satisfactorily. Through the good qualities of the ruler, the citizens become very happy and well qualified. Text 11. Although King Gaya had no personal desires for sense gratification, all his desires were fulfilled by the performance, by virtue of his performance of Vedic rituals. All the kings with whom Maharaj Gaya had to fight were forced to fight on religious principles. Even the people he was fighting with, he was so powerful and fixed in the principles, the proper principles of doing everything. Even in fighting, he fought according to principles. There are so many wonderful principles in fighting that you can only fight with an enemy on equal terms. If his bow breaks and you have a bow and he has to pick up his sword, it's not fair. It's not appropriate or for you to use a bow against someone with a sword. It's too easy to kill him. It doesn't show your prowess. So there are so many principles. Never shoot an, you can't shoot an enemy from behind if he's running. So many principles. So he forced, by his observance of the principles, he forced everyone to follow them. So they were satisfied with his principles. They respected his character so highly that they would present all kinds of gifts to him. Similarly, all the brahmanas in his kingdom were very satisfied with Maharaj Gaya's munificent charities. Consequently, the brahmanas contributed a sixth of their pious activities for King Gaya's benefit in the next life. So he satisfied the brahmins, he satisfied the kshatriyas, he satisfied the citizens in general by protecting them, and they got their needs met, physical needs met. So everyone was satisfied with this exalted personality. Text 12. In Maharaj Gaya's sacrifices, there was a great supply of the intoxicant known as soma. King Indra used to come and become intoxicated by drinking large quantities of soma ras. Also, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, the Jagya Purusha, also came and personally accepted all the sacrifices offered unto him with pure and firm devotion in the sacrificial arena through Bhakti Yoga. Sudha Chala Bhakti Yoga. Shraddha Vishuddha Achala Bhakti Yoga. He accepted everything because it was offered with devotion. So Prabhupada's purport, Maharaj Gaya was so perfect that he satisfied all the demigods who were headed by the heavenly king Indra. Lord Vishnu himself also personally came to the sacrificial arena to accept the offerings. Although Maharaj Gaya did not want them, he received all the blessings of the demigods and the Supreme Lord himself. Now why? Why would Prabhupada say he did not want the blessings of these persons, of the demigods or the Lord?
That wasn't his
purpose. Yes, that's exactly right. It wasn't his purpose. He wasn't performing the sacrifice to get something from them, just to give, to please them. That was his purpose. If one performs some activity to gain something from the Lord, other than the Lord's pleasure, then it is not Shuddha Bhakti. Not pure devotion. So that is Bhagavad Dharma. That is the religion of Krishna consciousness. That is pure devotional service. That is what's non-sectarian that we preach. That the survive pumso paradomo yatya bhakti hoksha jaya haitukiya pityataya yatma supasidite. That real religion is to please Krishna. That is the natural consciousness of the soul, to act in that way, not be selfishly motivated in any way whatsoever. So he was so wonderful, this Maharaj Gaya. 13. When the Supreme Lord is pleased by a person's actions, automatically all the demigods, human beings, animals, birds, bees, creepers, trees, grass, and all other living entities, beginning with Lord Brahma, are pleased. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Supersoul of everyone, and he is by nature fully pleased. Nonetheless, he came to the arena of Maharaj Gaya and said, "I am fully pleased." So Prabhupada ends his purport to 13 by saying, who can compare to Maharaj Gaya? So wonderful. The Lord himself said, I'm completely satisfied by your service. In the womb of Gayanti, Maharaj Gaya begot three sons. So his name was Gaya, his wife's name was Gayanti. He begot three sons named Chitrarata, Sugati, and Avarodhana. In the womb of his wife Orna, Chitrarata begot a son named Samrat. Samrat means emperor. The wife of Samrat was Utkal, and in her womb Samrat begot a son named Marichi. In the womb of his wife Bindumati, Marichi begot a son named Bindu, so this is more descendants. In the womb of his wife Sharagha, Bindu begot a son named Madhu. In the womb of his wife named Sumana, Madhu begot a son named Viravrata. In the womb of his wife Boja, Viravrata begot two sons named Mantu and Premantu. In the womb of his wife Satya, Mantu begot a son named Bhovana. And in the womb of his wife Dushana, Bhovana begot a son named Twasta. In the womb of his wife Virochana, Twasta begot a son named Viraj. The wife of Viraj was Vishuchi. And in her womb, Viraj begot 100 sons and one daughter. Of all these sons, the son named Satyajit was predominant. And the final verse in this chapter, 16. There is a famous verse about King Viraja. Because of his high qualities and wide fame, King Viraja became the jewel of the dynasty of King Priyavrata, just as Lord Vishnu, by his transcendental potency, decorates and blesses the demigods. Purport. Within a garden, a flowering tree attains a good reputation because of its fragrant flowers. Similarly, if there is a famous man in a family, he is compared to a fragrant flower in a forest. Because of him, an entire family can become famous in history. Because Lord Krishna took birth in the Yadu dynasty and the Yadavas have remained famous for all time. Because of King Viraja's appearance, the family of Maharaj Priyavrata has remained famous for all time. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 5th canto, 15th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, the glories of the descendants of King Priyavrata. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Before I forget, we'll have class next week, most likely on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I say most likely because if His Holiness Bhanuswami comes at that time, then he'll be giving class. So we'll see. Maybe it's not most likely, but at least partially likely we'll have class on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So there will be class, in any case, if Krishna allows. Any questions or comments?
Why does Srimad Bhagavatam, there's obvious reasons, but there are a lot of family religions there. So are we supposed to take some message from that other than the fact that these people mention that it is?
Well, in the 9th canto, there's especially a lot in the of family lineages leading, describing all the dynasties. And one thing that we learn from it, as the 9th canto describes, is about the passage of time. Here we think everything is very significant in our life. Something happens and very good happens to us, and we think it's so wonderful. And something bad happens and we think, oh, how terrible. But actually in the scope of time, in the passage of time, and we see just that list over there was probably thousands of years. So what is the significance of something that's passing so rapidly, the good and the bad, that's temporary? So one of the things that impressions that should come to us from reading these descriptions of the different dynasties is that even though someone may be great, in the dynasty. He still passes one after another. They pass. This one has his time, and this one has his time, and then the next one and his son has his time, and his son has his time, and it just passes and passes and passes. So much so that in the fifth canto, it's described that a life of Lord Brahma even. And this is a life of one Manu. And there are 14 Manus in a day of Brahma, 14 in a day of Brahma. And then there's a day of Brahma, and there's so many days of Brahma, and there's so many months of Brahma, and so many years of Brahma. And a lifetime of Brahma is compared to a flash of lightning on the ocean, compared to eternity. Practically, it doesn't even exist. So that's another thing that we learn. In addition to hearing something about how great personalities did things, it's better to have heroes who succeed and are wonderful in our generation. There are no heroes, there are anti-heroes, there are heroes that are not heroes at all. For so many years it's been like that. It's been the everyone has feet of clay and is fallible. No one looks up to anyone. Everyone looks down on everyone. And it's very poor for the consciousness. So we see that the Mahabharata, for example, and the Ramayana is there. Why? Because they give us great heroes to emulate. The Bhimas, the Yudhisthira would not tell a lie. The chaste ladies. Yeah.
So these family lines.
Yes, these are all king. Yeah, of
so
kings.
In one sense, they give us an example. Yes. To aspire to.
Yes. Teach us morality as well. They also give us a sense of time, the descriptions of them. So, yeah. Yeah.
Any difference between something the school of Buddha and Buddhism?
The school of Buddha?
Yeah.
Where is that? The school of Buddha? Is that a school, a physical school somewhere?
It's a philosophy.
Oh, the okay. Yes. Of the philosophy of Buddhism and? On the Buddhism? Well, the philosophy of Buddhism, according to the Bhagavatam, is to cheat everyone. To say, stop the Vedic sacrifices, there is no God, but worship me. So that's very different from what Buddhists conceive of as what they're doing. The Buddhists have their own, they have their own scriptures. What language is it? Anyone know?
Pali.
Not Nepali. That's Pali. It's not even full Nepali. That's part and partial. Just Pali, which is it's like a local language of Sanskrit spoken improperly. That's basically what it is. It was just a local language of 2,500 years ago. And his teachings weren't his actual teachings, because he taught that there was no God. He was a Gnostic, an atheist. He taught that, but he himself was God, and he got the people worshipping him. So there's a difference between Buddha's purpose and his teachings. Of course, the Buddhists won't accept that.
The Bhagavatam was written way before Buddha appeared, so is this another incarnation of Buddha?
No, he's not. But the people accepted him as they according to the purport, they improperly accepted him as Buddha.
Yeah, what if Baba says, okay, he says it's God like Buddha.
What's the Sanskrit word use? Yeah, I don't know any more about I don't know any more about really what the followers of Sumati are they like Jains or something, or the Arya Samaj? What's the connection? Huh? David, it just generally means demigod. Anyone know? Do the Jains accept? Do they worship Sumati also? Because they have a whole long list of the Buddhists. There's so many people. The Buddhists worship Maitreya, Rishi. The Buddhists, everyone, and all the Jains, I think, also worship Maitreya. There's all. And in Thailand, when you go there, they have in the Buddhist temples, they have. They use all the names of all the Vedic personages, Vishwakarma, this and that, but it's all different. You've been to the Buddhist temples? You saw the big sleeping Buddhas, and why is Buddha sleeping? Why is Vishnu sleeping? Same principle. To show that even though he's doing everything, he's doing nothing. He doesn't rest, and everything goes on. That's God. Why just rest all the time? Better to play a flute. Better than resting. That's what, while everyone, at night, while everyone is resting, that's what Krishna would do. He'd play his flute. Why rest? And then dance. And if there was a full moon tonight, there's no Purnima this year, right? It's gone. Sasha, what did you do with it? Where's the Purnima? Tomorrow is Chaturdasi, and then the next day is Pratipat. So if there was a Purnima, there's a rasa dance on this Purnima. But tomorrow night will be the last day of Kartik. And then on Sunday, finished. Pratipat. And on that night, and then there's a rasa dance. So Krishna doesn't just sleep. Okay, so on Monday, if Krishna allows, we'll have class. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.